Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
The end of the end of history and the return of power politics. Josef Joffe. A quarter of a century ago, my Stanford colleague Francis Fukuyama proclaimed the end of history in an article for the National Interest, then in a book that reverberated around the world. The short take was this: liberalism, democracy, and capitalism had won. The ideological wars that had tormented the 20th century were over. Fascism, Nazism, and Bolshevism were safely buried. The future now belonged to the liberal faith of the West, capitalism, democracy, and all. A third of a century ago, this was not a fairy tale, but a compelling account of the new world. Think back to 1989. The Berlin Wall had fallen, and with it the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe. 2 years later, on Christmas Day 1991, the Soviet Union was no more. The first empire in history to die in bed. Democracy was on a roll, with dictatorships crumbling and market economies giving way to state-run systems. What a wonderful end to the bloodiest century in history, which had culminated in the death of 20 million military personnel and 40 million civilians in the Second World War. Alas, this happy ending lasted for just 10 years. The end of history was over on 9/11/2001, when New York's World Trade Center went down in flames. The old ideologies had been buried, but suddenly there was a new one, just as murderous as the old ones. Only the colour had changed, from the red banner of Bolshevism and the brown shirts of Nazism to the black flag of the Islamic State. So we had equated a brief respite with the dawn of a new age. Let us put this more conceptually. The death of particular ideologies does not bespeak the end of ideology as such, the mightiest driver of conflict in history. Ideology never dies. It just keeps reappearing in ever-changing guises. Ideology, religious or secular, justifies why I, my faith, my tribe, my class, or my nation should have more than you, more power, wealth, or status. In that sense, ideology is a historical constant. While Bolshevism, Fascism, and Nazism have succumbed, there is now a long new lineup: Islamism, nationalism, populism, anti-capitalism, neo-authoritarianism, postmodernism. Even good old socialism has been making a comeback, even in the United States, where self-proclaimed socialist Bernie Sanders almost wrested the Democratic presidential nomination from Hillary Clinton in 2016. A mainstay of Western thought, the end of history, is a familiar dream that has always failed. Jews dreamt of the Messiah who would lead them to the world to come. Christianity promised transcendence and salvation. In the 18th century, the French philosophes Condorcet and Turgot saw history as a multi-stage process through which misery would yield to inevitable progress and the birth of a utopian society. Hegel believed in the transcendence of all conflicts, as did Marx. Socialism would end the class struggle that had dominated human history, spawning a world of plenty and justice. All such predictions have ended up as beautiful tombstones in the graveyard of the philosophy of history that supposedly revealed the inevitable march toward perfection. The reasons were always the same, rooted in the nature of man and politics. Instead of progressing toward its predestined end, history has always come back to thwart the finest dreams of mankind. So how has history come back since the fall of the Berlin Wall? We may count five new types of conflict that torment the current world. 1. The return of Russia. This is the return of history in its 19th century guise. We thought that at least in Europe, conquest and war had gone for good, as actually it had in 1945, ending the final chapter of 500 years of great power conflict on the continent. The end of strategic conflict was just a break, following the longest period of peace Europe had ever seen. The annexation of the Crimea and the de facto grab of southeastern Ukraine have put an end to this happy state. It is back to the future, except that Vladimir Putin's Russia invokes not communism, but nationalism fortified by orthodoxy as a national religion. It is about power, possession, and expansion, as in centuries past. Russian military spending has been rising at double-digit rates. Moscow has been abrogating disarmament treaties and probing NATO defences all over the European periphery. Russia is back in the Middle East, from whence Kissinger and Nixon had extruded the Soviet Union some 40 years ago. Today it is fighting a bloody war in Syria in order to guarantee the victory of the Assad regime. The victims, as the destruction of Aleppo shows, are mainly civilians. 2. The resurgence of geopolitical rivalry in Asia. In the Pacific as well, it is back to the future of the 19th century. Like Russia, China is arming at speed. It is claiming territories in the South China Sea, and it is building an area denial capability, threatening the US Navy with long-range bombers and a growing blue water navy. Essentially, Beijing is signalling to the US, the Western Pacific is our lake, roll over. But the strategic competition between the US and China is more subtle than in Europe. It is more akin to chess than to kickboxing. This rivalry is encased by strong firewalls of economic interdependence. This will not be a remake of Japan versus the US, which had hardly any economic ties in the 1930s. America and China have them in spades today, so the logic of mutual gain tends to contain the zero-sum game of power politics, where my gain is your loss. On the other hand, there is a historical footnote. In 1913, Britain and Germany were each other's second biggest customers, and that did not keep them from going to war in 1914. 3. The return of the 17th century with the weapons of the 21st in the Middle East. Why 17th century? This label refers to the religious wars that embroiled two branches of Christianity, Catholicism and Protestantism, in the cruelest warfare Europe had ever seen. Those who have God on their side need not compromise. They fight to subjugate or eliminate. In today's Middle East, it is the same story, only it involves Shia versus Sunni within a general melee that has embroiled America, Russia, Iran, France, Britain, and the Gulf states. The flashpoints are Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, and Afghanistan. The religious war is part and parcel of classic great power rivalry. Add to the bloody brew of 17th century confessional conflict the weapons of the 21st century, missiles, jets, drones, and cyber warfare, all of them in the shadow of nuclear weapons that will surely spread if Iran does, in the end, acquire its own nuclear capacity. 4. The curse of failing and failed states. In this arena, the return of history goes back even further than the 17th century, to the days before the European nation-state began to bestride the stage around 1500. This is the drama of violence in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, Nigeria. The war not across borders, but within borders. Why should this be? After all, these countries had harbored hostile faiths and tribes in the past and still endured as states. The answer is that there is no longer a central power to suppress conflict and enforce order. The strongmen, like Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, are dead, and Assad will stay in power only as long as he has the backing of Russia and Iran. The cynic might say, "So, let them kill each other." This is the wrong answer, because such failed states inevitably suck in outside powers. Iran's fingerprint is all over the region from Lebanon to Iraq. Russia intervened openly in 2014, and so did Turkey. Reluctantly, the US has been sucked in again. Having left Iraq in 2011, the US has been dispatching advisors and heavy equipment while bombing in Syria and Iraq. Israel is keeping a tense watch on the sidelines, always ready to go after Hezbollah, Iran's surrogate. Recall that the First World War was unleashed by a third-rate power named Serbia. 5. The Terror Wars. Terrorism is so hard to combat because it is do-it-yourself warfare that needs no army or general staff. Terror cannot be eradicated because it offers no targets, just a handful of men willing to die for the greater glory of God. Terror has no return address, hence it is so difficult to locate and destroy. It relies on hit-and-run, dispersal, surprise and concealment among the civilian population. Nor can terror be deterred, for suicide bombers want to die. Here, too, it is a mix of the 17th and 21st centuries. Faith as force multiplier is an old story that goes back to the Islamic conquest from Persia to Spain. Now shift forward to the 21st century and look at how skillfully Islamist terror uses social media. When Islamic State stages a beheading, it puts the gruesome show on YouTube. The internet provides a low-cost propaganda and recruiting platform. Islamist terror is both very old and very new. Digital images plus low-tech hunting knives. The whole world has to see it and be terrified according to the classic motto of terror, the propaganda of the deed, first promulgated by Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin. In Europe, this DIY warfare has come down to a single man renting or hijacking a truck and ploughing through the Promenade des Anglais or the Christmas market on Berlin's Breitscheid Square, inflicting dozens of casualties. In the US, there is no longer the need for a well-prepared operation such as the one masterminded by Al-Qaeda that brought down the Twin Towers and claimed 3,000 lives. It no longer takes 18 terrorists, as on 9/11. One was enough to murder 49 people at an Orlando nightclub in 2016. These are the five ways in which history is back, but with the tools and techniques of the 21st century. Are there any upsides? There may be three. First, it is not clear how the past could prevail. Take Russia. Eventually, Putin will have to look at the balance sheet. He may be winning on the battlefield, but he is losing at all other gaming tables. His economy has barely come out of its tailspin. Russian public expenditures are hostage to the oil price. Russia's best and brightest are leaving the country in droves. A rational soul would think that Putin would have better things to do with his dwindling cash than take on the Crimea as a welfare case while reaping US and European sanctions. In the old days, Ukraine was the breadbasket of Europe. Today, it is a basket case that must import food. Putin should have known that conquered land does not add to riches, but to painful costs incurred by sanctions, inflation, and prosecuting the war. In the abstract, Back to the Future is the wrong choice for a country that will decline unless it joins the global knowledge economy. In addition, Russia is a demographic horror story, with a shrinking population and a life expectancy lower than some African countries. Imagine that Putin had put his money not into geopolitical adventure, but into public health and education. Those would have been investments in real future power. Now consider, secondly, the innate weakness of Islamist terror. Al-Qaeda et al. Were on a roll as long as they exploited the unique advantages of asymmetric warfare. Hit and run, leave no tracks, melt back, swimming like fish in the water, as Mao famously put it. Yet in Syria, groups like al-Nusra, an offshoot of al-Qaeda, could not prevail against the Assad regime once it had the full military support of Russia, followed by Iran. As ruthless as the Islamist insurgency is, it falters when up against equally ruthless states that have no qualms about flattening Syrian cities like Aleppo. Once the Islamic State cast off the classic advantages of terrorism, it was in trouble. Once terror has a capital, like Raqqa or Mosul, it has an address that makes it vulnerable. By fighting in large formations with heavy weapons and long supply lines, ISIS offers lots of targets to the air forces of the US, France, and Britain. Then asymmetry turns in favor of states. A few years back, ISIS was at the gates of Baghdad. Now it is fighting a rearguard action as it confronts the superior technology of the US and its allies: smart munitions, drones, and space-based surveillance. Third, for all its sophistication and cruelty, terror does not pose a strategic threat to the West. Terror does best by inflicting isolated mayhem, be it in Paris, Nice, or Berlin. It dominates the headlines, but it cannot break the will of target states, be it Israel, America, France, or Germany. Indeed, terror has strengthened cohesion and resistance in all these nations. There is a larger moral to this tale. While Fukuyama was making waves with his End of History, Samuel Huntington scored a global hit with his book, Clash of Civilizations. The most memorable phrase from it was, "Islam has bloody borders," followed by, "The West against the rest." Actually, it is not us against them, but them against them. In Europe, terrorist incidents reached their peak in the 1970s and 1980s, and they were perpetrated more often by European nationals for secular reasons than by Islamists, homegrown or imported. Ever since, the frequency of terror attacks in Europe has been in steep decline, no matter how gruesome the bloodbaths in Paris, Brussels, or Nice have been. Islam's bloody borders run on the inside of this civilization, claiming 1,000 times more victims among Muslims than Westerners. The death toll in Syria has reached 500,000. In the Iran-Iraq war, the number of casualties was estimated at 1 million. The clash of civilizations is a misnomer. In fact, the Arab-Islamic world is a civilization of clashes, as the British historian Neil Ferguson has put it, meaning that terror and war claim more lives by orders of magnitude inside this world than in the West. What can the West do about it? Not much, is the dismal answer. These murderous fires must burn themselves out, and taking the history of religious warfare in Europe as an analogy, this may take a century or more. The strategic imperative is to contain the violence, to use the asymmetric advantages of the West, and to destroy ISIS on the battlefield. Why not be more ambitious? Iraq and Afghanistan have taught us that standoff weapons can kill with precision, but they cannot restore or maintain political order. Let us now shift from the realm of the crescent to the West and divide the world into two segments. One is what we might call the Moscow-Baghdad-Beijing belt, where history, rivalry, and mayhem have returned, or never disappeared. The other may be called the Berlin-Berkeley Belt, where war has become inconceivable and where cooperation and mutual gain have ruled since the end of the Second World War. In the Berlin-Berkeley Belt, history isn't returning, but is rather forging ahead at electronic speed. This is where Google and Apple call the shots, not the Kremlin or ISIS. The epicenter of this new world is Silicon Valley. It is the place where the future is being invented 24/7 and by a microcosm of the world. Americans, Indians, Chinese, Germans, Israelis, Russians. There is nothing like it in history. The heroes are not generals, but the great disruptors who go for virtual empire, not for the real one Putin is trying to reconstitute in Eastern Europe and, softly, China in Asia. The tools of conquest are not armies. The new sources of power are invention and broad and deep capital markets. It is based on brains and somebody else's money. It is universities like Stanford. It is the freedom to think and invest, to dream and to fail. Such assets are not rampant in the Moscow-Baghdad-Beijing belt. The Berlin-Berkeley belt is the future, while Putin is the past. And terror, no matter how spectacular, merely kills. It does not build. In the old days, riches came from land, from what was on and in it. People, fields and forests above, and coal, iron and gold below. In the past, it was perfectly rational to conquer lands. They added to power. Not today. Riches come from talents and skills, and the capital that turns knowledge into production. Neither Putin nor international terrorism have what it takes to succeed. A quick checklist. The rule of law, property rights, an independent judiciary, unfettered media, a state that provides order and security without suppressing the freedom to think and to do. Putin's Russia does not have such riches. The Arab Middle East does not have them either. Israel, Japan, and South Korea do. But China, for all its spectacular growth in the past, does not. How can you build great universities without freedom of thought? How do you grow a creative enterprise class in China, where the almighty Communist Party controls what Lenin called the commanding heights of the economy? In a contest that effectively pits the 17th and 19th centuries against the 21st century, can we imagine that Putin and Islamist terror, or even China, can win this competition? The task is to make sure that the Berlin-Berkeley belt can hold off the past. In the long run, the future is bound to win. But in the long run, as Keynes famously mused, we'll all be dead. For all the good news, the short-term asymmetries favour the 17th and 19th century forces. They are more ruthless, while the West is messy and self-absorbed, and reluctant to fight. Yet there is a new downside, which we could call the sixth new feature of the contemporary world, and that is the rise of populism on either side of the Atlantic. In the US, populism has conquered the White House, with Donald Trump installed as the 45th president. In Europe, neo-authoritarianism is in charge in Poland and Hungary. In France, the National Front of Marine Le Pen is expanding. In Britain, populism has driven the country into Brexit. From Madrid to Malmö, from Amsterdam to Athens, populism, which is always both left and right, is on a roll. What is the common denominator? The target is the liberal order of the Berlin-Berkeley belt that has been blessed with peace and institutionalized politics for 70 years. Its mainstays have been freedom of movement for people, goods, capital and services across borders. On the inside, the girders of this order have been the rule of law, peaceful change in power and conflict resolution by give and take. The populist revolt, victorious in the United States and semi-victorious in Britain, threatens the fabric of this benign post-war order. It wants to bring back the walls of the nation-state and seek strength in self-isolation. The phenomenon is not the aggressive nationalism of the 19th and early 20th centuries, but defensive nationalism, which is a new turn in the history of the West. Pull up the drawbridges and man the ramparts. The trends by no means bespeak the return of fascism and National Socialism in their Russian and German versions, though these movements also rested on autarky and independence. On the other hand, the new defensive nationalism comes with the lure of neo-authoritarianism. The inchoate message is that liberalism, parliamentarism, and internationalism have betrayed us, the people, while shifting power to the elites. Hence the attraction of strong men and women like Le Pen, who will set things right by cutting through the messy, frustrating procedures of the liberal democratic dispensation. History does not repeat itself. It just comes back in different and surprising guises. Nor is there that inevitable progress toward moral and political perfection, as the West's great figures from Moses to Marx propounded. Which direction is history heading in now? To know the future is not given to ordinary mortals, but one trend cannot be denied. Over the last 70 years, the West has held its own against the outside enemies of the liberal order. Now the Berlin-Berkeley belt is being challenged from the inside. That revolt comes not from latter-day brown shirts, nor does it come from the deplorables, as Hillary Clinton called them in her 2016 campaign, but from significant parts of the Democratic electorate. To regain their loyalty may be more demanding than to contain the return of power politics in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and in the Pacific. Russia, as Barack Obama proclaimed at the end of his tenure, may well be on the wrong side of history. Islamist terrorism may also join it there. But as the 21st century moves on, it is far from clear that the Berlin-Berkeley belt is still squarely on the right side of history, quite as surely as it seemed to be when the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.